This is the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan.
Good morning and welcome to the Post-Gazette Roundtable here on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan. I'm your host, Post-Gazette Sports Editor Jerry Micco, and I am joined today by Post-Gazette's Colin Dunlap and Fan Evening Show host Andrew Filippone. On this week's show, guys, we're going to take a look at this at the battle in Baltimore. Steelers-Ravens, that's the big talk this week. Actually, the hits from last week are the big talk this week, but Ravens-Steelers nonetheless. And we're going to take a look at the local college scene, and then we're going to talk about the hottest team in Pittsburgh on ice, the Penguins. But first, let's start with the Steelers. Colin, I want to start with you on this. This does have the feel of a playoff game. I mean, it's Ravens-Steelers, and it's late in the season, 8-3, tied at the top of the division. You know, the Steelers kind of eke one out. I guess you could say that in Buffalo. What other way to say it? What do you look for this week? What kind of game? Is this going to be a game where it's all defense? Are you going to see a little bit of offense this game? What are you looking
for?
No,
I think you'll see some offense. I think you'll see Baltimore move the football, actually. I think you'll see Baltimore win. I think the Steelers will have a hard time going down there offensively. I think you have to pay keen attention now, as you saw in our paper this morning, Jerry, with what's going on with Ben Roethlisberger. I think that's the one single most, the single most important component to this game and how he reacts, what happens with that foot, how he's able to move around. I mean, he's a guy where his escapability is unlike anybody else's in the league in terms of when he moves out of that pocket. Not necessarily his escapability after he breaks the line of scrimmage, but his escapability behind the line of scrimmage and how he fends off tacklers. If he's not able to do that, that takes away a large portion of what he does as a quarterback and how he keeps plays alive. If he can't do that, if he's limited mobility-wise, the Steelers are in big trouble.
Well, he was banged up, and he was still able to make some of those plays in the Buffalo game. I mean, that 3rd-and-17 conversion might end up being one of the plays we look back at the end of the regular season and say it was at that point that the Steelers kind of became a playoff team. And I, just from watching the Ravens-Buccaneers game last week, you know, Josh Freeman is a player that I think build-wise and play-wise is maybe like a Ben Roethlisberger light. And he bounced off a lot of Ravens tacklers. I mean, one of the reasons why Tampa Bay was able to stay in that game is because the Ravens pressure would come and Freeman would be able to prolong the play. And if Freeman had success doing that against Baltimore, then I think Ben Roethlisberger will have the same. I think there's a reason why the Steelers can't beat the Ravens without him. And when they got him on the field, they're 7-2 against him. So I do think that, Jerry, both offenses and Colin, both offenses will be able to move the ball. And I think the Steelers have the edge on the road with Roethlisberger in the lineup.
Well, it should, you know, the thing with Ben is, too, I mean, he's got, he does have Baltimore's number, it seems. I mean, when he plays, they do very well. But he is going to be a little hobbled. Let's see. I'd like to see if the Steelers are going to try to balance that offense or try to throw first, get Ben maybe some quicker throws in there or not. Let's hear from one other camp here. We're joining us on our show, Len Pasquarelli of the Sports Exchange by phone. Lenny, a Pittsburgh native, thanks for joining us today. Great to have you on the Post-Gazette Roundtable.
Oh, my pleasure. Glad to do it.
Yeah, Len, I asked that question. Ben Roethlisberger, you've read the reports that we've had in the PG and everything about a broken foot. You know, do you think, how limited is he going to be, and how limiting can that injury be to a guy like Roethlisberger who seems to play through just about anything?
Well, I think it'll be limiting. I mean, I wrote this morning in my column that, you know, we can parse semantics all we want about is the foot broken or not, and yeah, you know, talk to all the medical people we want to, but you know, my good friend Ed Buschetta is out there every day, and I believe what he writes, and I think it'll be limiting. But I wrote that I think Roethlisberger is prepared to take a painkiller shot. No big upset there. They've obviously, as the Post Gazette has detailed, have built him you know, some support into his cleat. But I think it's still important. You know, this is, as you guys pointed out, it's Pittsburgh-Baltimore, and I saw the Ravens here in Atlanta where I live a couple weeks ago on a Thursday night against the Falcons, and was a little bit disappointed that they weren't as suffocating a defense as they've been in the past. But, you know, all bets are off in this game. They're going to come after Ben. That's like chum in the water, the report that he's got a broken foot. And, you know, they've always put a lot of pressure on him, as the Steelers have on Joe Flacco as well. And I would expect nothing less in this game.
Lennon, that Baltimore-Atlanta game you're referring to, Roddy White was able to, I guess, expose that Ravens secondary a little bit. Him and Ryan had a nice connection in that game.
That's being kind.
It is. It's being very kind. So I wonder, Len, you've seen it firsthand. How do you beat the Ravens offense? Is it by establishing the ground game, or do you throw over the top of them?
I think their cornerbacks are really weak. I know in the game here that White essentially chased Ladarius Webb off the field. And, you know, they had some injuries that game. Ed Reed hadn't been back a long time before that, and he's a difference maker in the secondary. But the cornerbacks are still weak. And, you know, I think they've got to get the ball, as Jerry said, you know, out quickly. You know, take some shots deep with Mike Wallace. But the big thing is protection. And with that offensive line as banged up as it's been, and even when healthy, not able to protect Roethlisberger all that well with his mobility and all, you know, I think it's going to be a problem. I still think in this kind of game that Baltimore rushes the quarterback a lot, and that, you know, Pittsburgh's going to have to throw the ball really, really well while maintaining the balance they had against Buffalo. It was nice to see Rashard Mendenhall get off in that game. I don't know that he'll be able to do that against the Baltimore front. But I think you beat him, and you beat him deep.
Lenny, you know, you're a guy from Bloomfield. I'm a guy from Sharpsburg, and we have a sense of provincialism, us Western Pennsylvanians, right? And I'm going to ask you an overarching question here, a bigger picture question. There's been all this talk on this radio air and all this talk in Western Pennsylvania about this NFL conspiracy against these hits, with James Harrison in particular and the Steelers in a bigger form. Do you believe any of that? Is the league out to get, Len, the Steelers and these fines and these late hits and these quarterback hits at all?
Well, you know what, Jerry, I don't want to sound like a homer and say, yeah, they're out to get Harrison. But I know as a former basketball referee, and maybe this is a bad analogy, but subconsciously you went into some games, you know, looking for that guy that you had been warned about, or a guy who maybe you refereed before and had some problems with. It's just human nature. And so I don't want to claim that James Harrison has been picked on, but, you know, Lord knows, how are you supposed to play the game? I'm kind of a throwback guy, and, you know, I admire the way James Harrison plays. You know, I think that the coach differently, to lower the hitting point, as Dick LeBeau referred to in Friday's Post-Gazette. It means you've got to practice hitting. You've got to practice tackling. And my contention is that, you know, it's the thing that coaches are most afraid of, is having to practice tackling again after 3 or 4 or 5 years of not practicing it much. It's been the most lost art in the NFL. And it might actually cause more injuries, because now you're going to force guys to hit during practice, which coaches don't want to do. But conspiracy theory, I don't know. But I do think that James Harrison has been, you know, somewhat victimized here, yeah.
Sports Exchange columnist Len Pasquarelli joining us here on the Post-Gazette Roundtable on 93.7 The Fan. Len, to kind of piggyback a little bit on that, when you look at this game, these are two defenses that are going to go after each other. You know, with the rule changes, or adjustments, transitions, however you want to call it, I mean, don't you still look for these two teams, and teams like Baltimore and Pittsburgh and the Jets, teams that have great defenses, they're really in the long run, Lenny. Do you really think they're going to change how they play and how they do things in midseason?
Well, change is difficult. We just remodeled our kitchen, and my wife is still throwing the garbage where it used to be instead of where it's supposed to be anymore. And so I know how difficult, you know, change is. Do I think these guys are going to change? No. And you know, I mean, you know, Rodney Harrison, who's hardly a guy you want telling people how to play the game, is on TV saying that you know, nothing but a suspension is going to deter these guys. He might be right, and maybe it'll take a suspension. But, you know, the fines keep piling up, and they're probably going to continue to pile up, because I don't see these two teams particularly, and maybe the Jets, as you said, changing a whole lot.
Well, Len, hey, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate you taking some time to come on with us, talk Steelers and NFL. That was Len Pasquarelli of the Sports Exchange. Lenny, thanks again.
Okay, my pleasure, guys.
Well, guys, you know, we talked about this, and Colin, you brought it up. It must be that Western Pennsylvania accent we all have. Lenny's, you know, we're all our Western PA guys. I'm a Newcastle guy, not a Sharpsburg guy. But
oh, well, you're better for it.
You know, in a game like this, you know what you're going to get. I mean, you know you're going to have guys hitting each other. You know there's going to be a big play. is this something where the Steelers is almost like a set this up? And I'm not saying the Steelers are doing this on purpose or the players are doing it, because if they say, well, you know, hey, that call we got against James in the first, you know, first quarter, just, you know, that's the way they're calling it and it killed us. Or if they win, can they say, hey, everybody's against us and now we're winning? I mean, is that a—
I think these both of these teams, Andrew, and you've probably noticed this over the past, what, half decade or so, these teams in particular thrive on us against the world. We hate everybody else except our fan base. We want to go into stadiums and have people boo us. We want to be the enemy. Have you noticed that, Andrew?
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, you had Ray Lewis comment about that earlier in the season when he got called for a tripping penalty on Carson Palmer that cost him that Bengals game in week two. And he said, you know, it's the Ravens that get that call is made against because we have this, you know, we're scapegoated or we're, excuse me, typecast as a team that is going to level a quarterback and we don't get the same amount of leeway that other teams get. And now you have the Steelers coming out on Wednesday and having that, I think very devised, preordained attack on the NFL. And they thrived for the first month of the season when they had an us against them mentality. We don't have our quarterback. People have written us off. We're still going to win. There's no premature death here. So I agree with that a lot, Colin. I think that both of these teams, and especially the Steelers, are trying to think up a way that can motivate them in a game like this.
There's only so many characters that can be played. You can only put people in so many sort of canisters. And both of these teams, if this was a Broadway play, if this was a musical, if it was a show, they want to be the villain. They thrive on that and they like it, and that's where they are. And whenever two villains hit, though, it's hard to, you know, unfortunately, neither one of them is going to move. They both want to be that guy.
Quick prediction, 10 seconds each. Colin?
I think the Steelers lose a close game.
I think the Steelers win a close game.
I think Steelers lose a close game. All right, guys, up next, we're going to look at the college football and basketball scene. This is the Post-Gazette Roundtable on 93.7 The Fan.
Back to the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan.
Welcome back. I'm Jerry Micco, and I'm with the PG's Colin Dunlap and Fan Evening Show host Andrew Filippone. Guys, busy weekend in college sports. Headlined by today's football game between Pitt and Cincinnati.
Sorry. Headlined by Pitt and Cincinnati cracks me up. Sorry, Colin.
This is the headliner. Pitt and Cincinnati.
Wow.
I'm telling you. This is the guys, now laugh if you wish, and Andrew already did, but it is the headliner game, so let's talk about it real quick. At best, an outside shot. Andrew, I'm going to let you start.
Sure.
Yeah, an outside shot at a Big East title and a BCS, but a lot's got to happen. West Virginia's got to lose to Rutgers. Probably not going to happen. Connecticut's got to lose to South Florida. Could happen. Let's talk about Pitt-Cincinnati, though. It's just, you know, it's going to take an awful lot, and this is kind of the capper, I guess, to a season that a lot of people consider a disappointment.
Yeah, if they win today, I cannot imagine that there are going to be Pitt fans who are so into this thing that they're going to be switching back and forth between channels or radio stations to find out how West Virginia is doing and then sitting on pins and needles watching UConn play South Florida tonight. Like, that, the Pitt season does not go that way with some, like, magical last day where everything you need to break right happens. That's not how Pitt works. You know, that's not how the Pitt fan is conditioned to think, that everything is going to fall into place for them. So I'm expecting Pitt to lose today. It would make total sense if they got blown out, and it would make even more sense if the other teams that they needed to lose also lost. So then if had they won, they would have gotten in.
Well, but Cincinnati, I'll say this. Ultimate. Cincinnati is the worst tackling team I've seen in a long time.
But they've got the best quarterback in the league, if you ask me. And that's their saving grace, is that they can play a game into the 40s. And I think they can play that game with the missed tackles. Let's see if Pitt in this contest can put the points on the board.
They left some points on the field against Connecticut last week, Cincinnati did. Like, they should have scored. They should have won. You look what UC did against UConn. They should have beat them.
And what, they scored 63 on Rutgers 2 weeks ago, Cincinnati?
Well, I think that Rutgers season went in the tank. Unfortunately, that Rutgers season kind of went in the tank when Eric LeGrand got injured, and they've never been able to rally back from it, really. And it's kind of, and that's why I don't think they have a chance at Mountaineer Field today. I think that West Virginia will blow them out at Senior Day, and kind of all that stuff will be, you know, blown out of the water with Pitt's chances.
You know, Andrew, I'm gonna run a little bit with what you said, because I think it's true. So if you're a Pitt fan, if you're a Pitt football fan, is that why this team the fan base just doesn't seem to get into? Is that it? Is it because year after year of frustration and bad games and games you shouldn't lose? I mean, is it just to the point now where, like, let's say Pitt wins tomorrow. Let's say West Virginia's not going to lose. Let's say they lose to Rutgers. at home. And Pitt went, you didn't mean to tell me that if you're a Pitt football fan, you're not glued to that TV?
No. Maybe you're checking the game on your phone. If you are a sucker and you sit down to watch that game, UConn will win. Because that is, and I know that I'm painting a very gloomy picture, but that's just the way the world spins around, Jerry, is that you have a team that trips and falls on itself every chance they get. And you know what? How can you really follow that team fervently? If I ask a girl out on a date and every time she denies me and she makes fun of me in the process, eventually I'm going to stop asking her out. I'm going to do things my own way.
Eventually.
And yes. And that's the thing with Pitt. How many times do you have to be hit over the head with a devastating loss to become apathetic?
And so this hurts them beyond. I mean, this hurts them as a fan base. I mean, I at some point, like when bowls are looking at teams to bring in, is Pitt just like, is Pitt going to bring anyone to a bowl game?
No, and that's why Louisville's going to leapfrog them. Louisville is more appetizing because Louisville is going to travel to a bowl game. I mean, Louisville will go to a better bowl with a worse record.
I mean, I don't understand. I understand that, but I don't understand it. I understand what you're saying, Andrew. But why is it? Is it just because of all the times they've tripped and fallen? It's like a pratfall.
No.
They were 11 and...
They're also different. They're also unique, not necessarily unique just in the league, but they're unique in that they have one of the most established NFL franchises playing in the same stadium and in the same city. And that is a unique situation. You know, you can't liken it to South Florida that also plays in an NFL stadium, but it's a different place. You can't liken it to the other markets in the league. I mean, it's a pro town, and they're always going to be second fiddle, vastly second fiddle, behind the Penguins and the Pirates and the Steelers. It's just how it is.
And that's right, but it's the way they lose, too. They usually do just enough to get you to buy back in, and then when you are invested in the team, they rip your heart out, like they did last year. First time ranked in the top 10 since Dan Marino was on the Pitt campus. You've got people buying right back in. What do they do? They go down to West Virginia. They lose on a last-second field goal. Big East is still there for them. They blow a 3-touchdown lead at home. So, and that's just one isolated season, Jerry. I mean, you could look the last 4 or 5 years under Dave Wansett, and those games pop up on the schedule every season.
Yeah. No, I agree with you, and I think that for a Big East team to really have that kind of a lot of things need to break right for nationally them to get some acclaim, for any Big East team to get some acclaim. Things, they don't need to just do what they have to do. Things need to break in front of them. You look at Cincinnati last year. They did exactly everything they needed to do. They still didn't get that opportunity. So, like with a Pitt team, they need to win out and things need to happen in front of them. Well, Pitt isn't even taking care of the first portion of it. No Big East team, really, other than Cincinnati, has been taking care of the first portion of that. It takes a whole lot. And, Andrew, you're right in that they have stepped on their own foot. Like, even in the West Virginia, in the backyard brawl last week, it comes down to Dave Wansett not recruiting a top quarterback. John Baldwin was open 2-3 times. If a good quarterback finds him, they probably beat West Virginia. They at least score an early touchdown.
But my contention would be you went into this season knowing that you were going to have average quarterbacking play. And if I submitted you Tino Sinceri's numbers before the season started, you would say, yep, we can still win the Big East with those kind of statistics. Because his numbers for his sophomore year are not all that different than Rod Rutherford's sophomore year, Tyler Pelko's sophomore year, and Bill Stull when he was a first-year starter. So I guess you could say, Colin, that is, you know, epidemic of this program.
They didn't think they'd get nothing from Deion Lewis.
Exactly. To me, it's less about the quarterback and more about the running back who was a Heisman Trophy candidate, was a shell of himself this season, and your defense, you know, you've got these bookend defensive ends, but yet when it's been put up or shut up time, have they gotten the stops that they've needed? And the answer is no.
And you roll out a litany. I'll go back to the brawl. I just thought West Virginia was so ready to play that game, so much more physical, so much more just ready to go in there, and then they got a break. Then they get a short field and a touchdown. And Pitt just seems to get – every time that happens to him, it seems like the air goes out of him. I'll even go back to Connecticut. The kid, Williams, returns to kick 95 yards after you go up 8. In a game, you're struggling on the road, but you get up 8 points, and it looks like here's where we can put these guys away. Mm-hmm. And they give up a 95-yard
touchdown. Well, you talk about breaks, and you talk about luck, and people talk about this and that. At some point, you become the common denominator. At some point, you aren't doing the things to make your own breaks. And I think, Andrew, that's what you were getting at, that – Pitt has become, again, its own worst enemy, and that's where it is. They're not making the plays. It's not that the other team, it's not that fortune is just in some mysterious way finding all these other teams. It's that Pitt's not doing these things.
You know, that's true, but there's is a certain, like you said, an intangible feeling that's like almost hovering over this team that almost reminds me of, on a much larger scale, of say like the Cubs. Like, you could be ahead and it looks like the path is right there in front of you, but you know, given all the, like, the pain and sorrow you've been through, that your team is going to find a way to screw it up.
So it's like this,
and I get that sense with Pitt.
Like those old cartoons where they paint the tunnel on the wall, and the wall is just really paint?
Yes.
It's not a tunnel?
I mean, am I exaggerating it, Jerry? Do you think that I'm off the mark? I really feel that way.
No, and I guess I was going to take that and take it one step further and say, if that's the case, then, is it coach? Is it coaching? Is it recruiting?
That's the question everybody's asked. You listen to Ron Cook's show. You listen to Joe Starkey's show. You listen to Andrew's show at night. You listen to the morning show. Everybody, that it seems to be on the coach. You wonder if at some point the players, yeah, they need to perform, but are they the right players in place? Is the right game plan in place? I don't know. I think that they could do better than in terms of a philosophy from a coach. I think that it's not necessarily Dave wants that. It's his philosophy. I don't like the whole let's keep it close and try to win in the fourth quarter. It doesn't scream to me that Dave wants that's philosophy, and the philosophy of his staff is every single play we run can hit for a touchdown. I watch a lot of college football. I cover a lot of college football, Jerry. When I watch other teams, it seems to me every offensive play that's run could go for a touchdown.
Arkansas,
when I watch
LSU last week,
absolutely.
Perfect example.
Even West Virginia, yeah. Even you watch Texas, who's been terrible this year. You know, you watch those plays and you say, if this breaks right, it's a touchdown. I watch Pitt and I say, if this play here goes, it's a 4-yard gain. And that's not the mentality that needs brought into a college football game.
I bring up coaching and recruiting because it was Deion Lewis a 1-year wonder? I mean, was he?
Maybe. I mean,
is that because Deion Lewis was always that kind of a player and he caught lightning in the
bottle? I think he was hurt.
Year?
I think he was injured a lot this year, but that's no excuse. I mean, injuries are part of football.
I think like a pitcher who comes out of nowhere and you just put the entire burden of your bullpen on his back to ask that person to come back the next year and give you the same kind of performance is asking too much. And when you have him rush the ball 47 times against Cincinnati as a freshman and you give him that kind of workload for the entire season, then you expect the same results the next year, that's too much.
But they had something that was you know, that nobody else in the league had this year. Sure, he was what? They had the ninth and the seventh leading rusher in the league going into last week, but if you combine those two guys, they had more yards rushing a game than Jordan Todman, right? I mean, they, in a sense...
Makes sense.
They, in a sense, had the top runner in the league if you put those two guys together, Ray Graham and Deion Lewis.
So if you're Steve Peterson and you're looking at your team at the end of the season, what do you do?
Unacceptable to me, Jerry, that in this league, and I know the Big East gets beat up probably more than it should, because most years, with this being one of the exceptions, there's usually a team that finishes in the top 10 or top 15. However, it is inexcusable to me that in 6 years, given the type of players that Pitt has been able to bring in and what they're standing comparatively to other teams in the league, that they have not gone to a BCS bowl. And you give him a 5-year contract extension through 2015 without that BCS bowl last year, I think that you're stuck with him. If you're Steve Peterson, can you buy him out? I don't think you can, Colin. I think that...
Well, you got to have alumni support, and you got to have money behind that, and if there's no fan support, how are you going to get alumni support?
Are the results fireable? I say yes. Is it a reality? I say no.
I think if you're Steve Peterson, you have to, whatever decision you make, and I'm not saying if you should fire him or if he shouldn't fire him, but he cannot look at... He needs to take this season and pull it away independently and really look at the body of work, and the body of work, I think, in the last 18 months has taken a nosedive.
Well, I think you're probably right. So, real quick, I think everybody's figuring West Virginia is going to win their game. What about Pitt? Real quick, Colin, they're gonna go right there. Gonna
yeah,
win this
I don't.
Game?
I think it's going to be 52-51, and
wow,
I don't know
like
who's going to win.
High score,
I think Zach Caleros looks like another local
terrific
quarterback who has a huge game. And you say we're stuck with Tino Cinceri. Why?
I'll count that as a Cincinnati win. Oh, it should be a good one today up at Nippert Stadium in Cincinnati. Next up, we're going to talk about the hottest team in Pittsburgh, the Penguins, with P.G. Shelley Anderson. This is the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan.
Back to the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Jerry Micco. Joining me, P.G.'s Colin Dunlap and Fan evening show host Andrew Filippone. Guys, time to talk about the Penguins. 8 in a row. Defeated Atlanta on Thursday night, a hat trick for Sid, and let's talk about him. He's got 21 goals. They're 27 games in. So is he going to make 60? Hasn't been a 60-goal scorer for a while, at least not named Ovechkin. in a while. So what do you think, Colin? I'll go ahead and
Colin, I know you've been foaming at the mouth to answer this question.
No, no,
I'll give you the floor first.
I followed
it's
it.
It's a layup question. It's Sid.
There's nobody hotter in all of sports, you know what, in the past 7-8 days, it would seem. And I just think that there have been shortcomings in other portions of that team. You take that all that nonsense early on with the goaltending stuff, everything that's gone on, Jordan Staal, when's he going to come back, what's going on with him? And Sidney Crosby just takes the team by the scruff of its neck and says, okay, I'm going to grab it. We're going to go. Follow me. Jump on board. Let's go. And, Andrew, there are leaders in sports, you know, and Jerry, there are leaders in sports. But for a guy to just quietly say, all right, enough's enough. All the scuttlebutt peripherally, forget about it. Just get behind me and go. You have to marvel, especially who's still a very young guy. Mm-hmm. To do that is phenomenal to me.
I think it's remarkable that in a very short amount of time, the conversation has kind of transformed or turned over from, like, okay, can he, like, be the Art Ross Trophy winner every year with, you know, the most points in the NHL? Is he going to lead the NHL in assists? To now he is, like, the number one goal scorer in this league. And I think that speaks to, you know, speaks volumes about just his transcendent ability as a hockey player. You know, 60 to me seems like a big number, but I don't really like to discount or rule out superstars from doing anything. So that number seems reasonable. There are 82 games in the season. I say, sure, can Sidney Crosby get to 60 goals? If anybody can do it, I'd put my money on him.
Well, joining us now is someone who sees Sidney Crosby just about every day, Shelly Anderson, the Post-Gazette hockey writer. Shelly, thanks for taking the time to join us here on the roundtable.
Oh, it's always my pleasure.
Well, you know, Shelly, I'll ask you because you do. You are around the team much more than any of us. Everybody sees what Sidney Crosby does on the ice. Is there a tangible off-ice benefit that he brings that you see that's a locker room-ish thing? Did he grab the team by the scruff of the neck and say, hey, we're going to get through this, and I'm going to show you how that's done?
I think he did, but I think it was a lot more subtle than you might think. I think it's just him being him, and I think that he's, you know, everybody talked about Sergei Gonchar when he was here and the kind of calming influence he had. And I think Sid has a little bit of that, too, on top of the, you know, go out and get them and being the hardest worker, whether it's off-ice workouts, on the ice, at practice, on the ice, in games, just whatever he's doing. But just the way he walks around the room and the way he doesn't get rattled, I think really is something that he had let some of the veteran players kind of take care of in past seasons. And I think he's kind of graduated to that level now where he's helping to fill that role. And then obviously just on the ice, it's the leading by example. I think the scoring streak has kind of underscored how well he's playing, and he has been incredibly dominant, more so than we've ever seen in his career to this point. But I think he's been pretty strong all season. I mean, he established himself as a tremendous face-off guy, which was a detriment early in his career, and you know, he's doing well in shootouts and breakaways, which was something that he had to work on early in the season. He's shooting from all over the place, which we first saw last season. And he's really kind of putting it all together this season, and the scoring streak is really kind of shining a light on that.
Shelly, what are some of those other facets of his game that you feel have been, I'm trying to find the words here, I guess are kind of pushed to the wayside because of his goal-scoring streak? You mentioned that you think that he's performing in other areas. What would those other areas be?
Yeah, maybe the word is underappreciated because of the goal scoring, which really kind of surfaced last season because basically he wanted it to. Some of the things I mentioned, the face-offs, I mean, he's not just taking pretty much more and winning more than anybody else in the league, but they're putting him out there sometimes specifically to take a face-off. I mean, they'll be in a tough penalty kill situation, maybe in the defensive zone, and they'll put him out on the ice just to take a face-off. Or if it's late in the closed game, they want to make sure he's out there, you know, even if it's just to go take the face-off and come off the ice and then go back on for his regular shift. That's a lot of confidence from a coach and someone who started off not very good in that. And, you know, that was only 3 or 4 years ago that he was not very good in that particular venture. So some of those things, and you just see the defensive play, just the headiness, just getting behind everybody last night in anticipation of a possible play that we saw that set up where Aaron Ashton set him up for a breakaway. I mean, you have to gauge that. There's risk and reward because he's leaving his team when the puck's in his zone that he needs to get back there and back check, and yet he felt comfortable taking off like that, and it resulted in a goal. So, you know, just those kinds of things, those kinds of heady plays, and all the little things that he does that we're finally kind of really seeing come to fruition, I think are all the intangibles beyond, you know, what the starry-eyed thing everybody sees, which is the goal and the points.
Shelley, to switch it up a little bit, it seems, I guess, fashionable it was, what, about a month ago for everybody to hate Marc-Andre Fleury, right? But everything sort of changed around, everything shifted around. How much of it is what he has done, and how much is it maybe Paul Martin, maybe guys like that in front of him playing a lot better?
It's definitely a combination. You hit both of them right on the head. I think Marc-Andre Fleury is the type of player, he can be a leader in his way, but he's not one of the foremost leaders on the team. In some ways, he's a follower, and it's not a character flaw. It's just that you can't have all leaders and no followers on a team. You've got to have players who look to other players. And I think that when a few things were going a little bad, so a lot of those defensemen were hurt, the team wasn't playing that well defensively in front of him, he had a soft goal, particularly the one against Scott Gomez from Montreal when they lost that game. Those things kind of conspired to rob him of a lot of his confidence, probably more so than I've ever seen in his career. But it also came back just like that, just when the table was set for him a game that he needed to play at home, and he won, and now all of a sudden he's playing as well as he ever has, too. So, you know, goalies can be like that. They can run hot and cold, and their confidence can come and go. But the way the team's playing, I don't see his confidence dipping again anytime too soon.
Shelley, I know that people within the organization have questioned Fleury's commitment at times. It came out at the end of last year. I remember reading an article by the late Jim Kelly about just his work ethic surrounding the team and how that could be better. Have you noticed or have you heard anything about maybe Fleury being more focused on hockey this season?
You know, as a matter of fact, I've probably heard the opposite. I understand how people can kind of gather that from him. He's kind of a loosey-goosey guy, and particularly, you know, kind of joking around and lighthearted and smiling all the time. It's hard for him, other than maybe after a loss or when things are really not going well, it's hard for him not to smile all the time. And I think people confuse that with being a little bit less than focused or a little less serious than some of his teammates. But if you watch him in practice, he takes it personally every time one of his teammates beats him in practice. And I think that he's as competitive as anybody else. He just has a little bit different personality than some of them and doesn't wear it on his sleeve as much.
Well, Shelley, thanks for the time and thanks for all the insights. We really appreciate it here on the roundtable.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Okay, that was Shelley Anderson of the Post-Gazette, the Penguins writer. And, Andrew, one thing we didn't get into with Shelley, but she just wrote a piece about it the other day, mm-hmm. in the Post-Gazette, was about Evgeny Malkin, the $8.7 million forward. Everybody says, is he worth that money? And what is he doing this year to earn it? He's a little bit of a mystery to me, I guess. He's always kind of been. But I just think he's such a wonderfully gifted guy. And to watch him play now, it almost seems like he's just lost. Is he just lost?
Well, they've changed his position. They have changed his line mates. They have taken his mentor, or I guess his rock, who was in the dressing room with him last year, and they jettisoned Gonchar to free agency, and he signed with Ottawa. So I think there's been a lot of change for Evgeny Malkin in a short amount of time. So to ask him to compete at a high level, I don't think is too much because, again, he is a superstar. But, you know, he's still also, a young, very temperamental player. So I think not to make too many excuses for him, I think that's probably why, Jerry, you've seen his numbers dip this season. I do like how much he's shooting. And when you're on a line with Matt Cook and Aaron Asham, I think it's important that you get pucks to the net. And he's done that this year.
When he gets it going, what is he, the fifth, sixth best player in the world at worst?
He's in the top 10, yeah.
He's in the top 10 for sure.
In a proportionate level, he's worth $8.7 million when he gets it going. When he gets hot in the playoffs, well, he didn't really get hot in the playoffs, but when he gets hot down the stretch, he's absolutely worth that money. You hedge your bets that he's going to get going, that he's going to be hot when you need him, right?
And when Stahl gets back, I think
right.
He'll be
even better. So you got to pay him that. I don't even think it's a discussion.
If I'm Evgeny Malkin, I'm apoplectic at the way the offseason went.
I agree.
The first thing you do is, you know, you've got to retract stories about whether or not he's on the trading block, mm-hmm. which would bother me. Then you take away one of my best friends in the dressing room. And then, oh, by the way, Evgeny, you're going to come out and play a new position this year. I mean, that's a lot to ask a player that is still relatively new to this entire culture.
And he's not 38 years old. Right. I mean, he's a young guy.
I just think he's a wonderfully talented guy. So it'd be great to see him get back on track and the Penguins make the Penguins even better. All right, next up, I read fan mail on the Post-Gazette Roundtable here on 93.7 The Fan.
You're listening to the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan. It's time for fan mail on the Post-Gazette Roundtable. Sports Radio 93.7, The Fan.
Welcome back to the Post-Gazette Roundtable here on 93.7, The Fan. It's time for our final segment that we call Fan Mail. And a reminder, if you'd like me to read your email on the air, please send it to me at jmicco, J-M-I-C-C-O, at postgazette.com, and we'll consider it for a future show. Please put the word roundtable in the subject line. This week's email is from John, who writes, "That's good news about TCU becoming a member of the Big East. It would be great news if the Big East exerts pressure on Notre Dame to become a football partner. Football is the key sport in terms of popularity, prestige, and revenue for most colleges. Having Notre Dame as a non-football member of the Big East really doesn't enhance the conference." Well, let's deal with two things here. One, John, and thanks for the letter, TCU and Notre Dame can't be two more different programs, and I don't care if TCU is the number three team in the BCS right now, Notre Dame is not ranked. Here's the deal. Notre Dame doesn't need to be a football member in the Big East. It really doesn't need it. Notre Dame can do whatever they want because they're Notre Dame. The money's going to be there. The prestige is going to be there. And you would even think the players are going to be there, especially now with Kelly there, that it'll be even better. So maybe at some point Notre Dame's going to say, hey, we're going to need to join a conference because we need to get involved in the BCS again and in a way where we can get an automatic bid. Now, that I can't imagine that conference would be the Big East. The Big East is not a good football conference. Let's look at TCU. On the other hand, here's TCU sitting out in Fort Worth. Terrific football program, mediocre basketball program. Here's the Big East. Great basketball league, mediocre to poor football league. TCU's looking for a home. The Big 12 didn't want them. The SEC wouldn't come in there and get them. The Pac-10, as part of their tech look at Texas, wouldn't look at TCU. So they were sitting there in the Mountain West saying, hey, we want to get an automatic bid. How do we do that? Well, we've got to join one of the automatic bid conferences. The BCS is looking to improve its football. It's a match made in heaven. TCU joins the Big East. Now they have a chance to be an automatic qualifier for a BCS bowl if they can win in what I consider a mediocre to bad football conference. And in basketball, they get the prestige of playing in the Big East. They're not going to be a player in the Big East. There's too many other great teams. So I think it was a match made in heaven. You can't really equate bringing Notre Dame in or having the Big East do that. Notre Dame is not going to be pushed around like that, and certainly not going to be pushed around by the Big East, especially when it comes to football. That does it for today's Post-Gazette Roundtable. I'd like to thank today's panel, Fan Evening Show host Andrew Filippone and the Post-Gazette's Colin Dunlap, and our guests, Len Pasquarelli, NFL columnist from the Sports Exchange, and the PG's Penguins reporter, Shelley Anderson. Finally, we do not get to do this show, get it done, or get it done right, certainly without the work of our producer, Matt Popchak. So I hope you'll join us next Saturday morning on Sports Radio 93.7, when our panel of sports reporters and guests will discuss the stories and issues surrounding sports here and around the nation. I'm PG Sports Editor Jerry Micco. Up next on The Fan, the Post-Gazette High School Sports Show with Mike White and Don Rebel. Have a great week, everyone.